Gold and ivory bracelets clattered softly as Aeron adjusted her dark shawl. She peered down as though trying to read Verin's thoughts. Aeron seemed to stand high among the wise ones, and while Verin occasionally had seen a smile crease those dark-tanned cheeks, a warm and easy smile, it was never directed at an Aes Sedai. "We never suspected that you would be the ones to fail," she had told Verin somewhat murkily. There had been nothing unclear in the rest of it, however. "Aes Sedai have no honor. Give me one hair of suspicion and I will strap you till you cannot stand with my own hands. Give me two hairs and I will stake you out for the vultures and the ants." Verin blinked up at her, trying to appear open. And meek, she must not forget meek. Docile and compliant. She did not feel fear. In her time she had faced harder stares from women and men, without so much as Aeron's slim compunction about ending her life. But a good deal of effort had gone into being sent to ask those questions. She could not afford to waste it now. If only these Aiel let more show on their faces. Abruptly she became aware that they were no longer alone in the tent. Two flaxen-haired maidens had entered with a black-robed woman a hand shorter than either. They were half-holding her upright. At one side stood Tialin, a lanky redhead wearing a grim expression behind the light of Saidar, shielding the black-robed prisoner. The sister's hair hung in sweat-soaked ringlets to her shoulders and strands that clung to her face, which bore so much dirt that Verin did not recognize her at first. High cheekbones, but not very high, a nose with just the hint of a hook to it, and the slightest tilt to the brown eyes. Beldine. Beldine Nairam, she had instructed the girl in a few novice classes. "If I may ask," she said carefully, "why was she brought? I asked for another." Beldine had no warder despite being green. She had been raised to the shawl barely 3 years ago, and greens were often especially choosy about their first. But if they started bringing whoever they selected, the next might have two or three warders. She thought she could deal with two more today, but not if either had even one warder, and she doubted they would give her a second chance at any of them. "Katerina Alruddin escaped last night," Tialin nearly spat, and Verin gasped. "You let her escape?" she burst out without thinking. Tiredness gave no excuse, but the words spilled from her tongue before she could stop them. "How could you be so foolish? She's red! And neither a coward nor weak in the power. The Karakarn could be in danger. Why were we not told of this when it happened?"
"It was not discovered until this morning," one of the maidens growled. Her eyes could have been polished sapphires. "A wise one and two Khor Dahri were poisoned, and the guy Shine who brought them drink was found with his throat cut."
Aeron arched an eyebrow at the maiden coldly. "Did she speak to you, Carahwin?" Both maidens suddenly became engrossed in the task of keeping Beldine on her feet. Aeron merely glanced at Tialin, but the red-haired wise one lowered her gaze. Verin was the next recipient of those attentions.
"Your concern for Randall Thor does you honor," Aeron said grudgingly. "He will be guarded. You have no need to know more. Or so much."
Abruptly her tone hardened.
"But apprentices do not use that tone with wise ones, Verin Mathwin, Aes Sedai."
The last words were a sneer.
Smothering a sigh, Verin all but fell into another deep curtsy, a part of her wishing she were even as slim as she had been on arriving in the White Tower.
She was not really constructed for all this bending and bobbing. "Forgive me, wise one," she said humbly.
"Escaped!"
The circumstances made everything plain, to her, if not to the Aiel.
"Apprehension must have loosened my wits."
A pity she had no way to make sure Katerina met with a fatal accident.
"I will do my best to remember in the future."
Not so much as the flicker of an eyelash told whether Aeron accepted that.
"May I assume her shield, wise one?"
Aeron nodded without looking at Tialin, and Verin quickly embraced the source, taking up the shield Tialin released.
It never ceased to amaze her that women who could not channel gave orders so freely to women who could. Tialin was not much weaker in the power than Verin, yet she watched Aeron nearly as warily as the maidens did, and when the maidens hurried out of the tent at a gesture of Aeron's hand, leaving Beldine wavering where she stood, Tialin was only a step behind. Aeron did not go, however, not immediately. "You will not speak of Katerina Alruddin to the Karakarn," she said. "He has enough to occupy his thoughts without giving him trifles to worry over."
"I will say nothing to him about her," Verin agreed quickly.
"Trifles? A red with Katerina's strength was no trifle. Perhaps a note. It needed thought." "Be certain to hold your tongue, Verin Mathwin, or you will use it to howl." There seemed nothing to say to that, so Verin concentrated on meekness and docility, making yet another curtsy. Her knees wanted to groan. Once Aeron departed, Verin allowed herself a sigh of relief. She had been afraid Aeron intended to remain. Gaining permission to be alone with the prisoners had required nearly as much effort as getting Sorelia and Amice to decide they needed to be questioned, and by someone intimate with the White Tower. If they ever learned they had been guided to that decision, it was a worry for another day. She seemed to be piling up a great many of those. "There's enough water to wash your face and hands, at least," she told Beldine mildly. "And if you wish, I will heal you." Every sister she had interviewed had carried at least a few welts. The Aiel did not beat the prisoners except for spilling water or balking at a task. The haughtiest words of defiance earned only scornful laughter, if that. But the black-robed women were herded like animals, a tap of the switch for go or turn or stop, and a harder tap if they did not obey quickly enough. Healing made other things easier, too. Filthy, sweating, wavering like a reed in the wind, Beldine curled her lip. "I would rather bleed to death than be healed by you," she spat. "Maybe I should have expected to see you groveling to these wilders, these savages, but I never thought you would stoop to revealing tower secrets. That ranks with treason, Verin. With rebellion," she grunted contemptuously. "I suppose if you didn't shy at that, you'll stop at nothing. What else have you and the others taught them besides linking?" Verin clicked her tongue irritably, not bothering to set the young woman straight. Her neck ached from looking up at Aiel. For that matter, even Beldine stood a hand or more taller than she. Her knees ached from curtsying, and entirely too many women who should know better had flung blind contempt and foolish pride at her today. Who should know better than an Aes Sedai that a sister had to wear many faces in the world? You could not always overawe people, or bludgeon them either. Besides, far better to behave as a novice than be punished like one, especially when it earned you only pain and humiliation. Even Kiruna had to see the sense of that eventually. "Sit down before you fall down," she said, suiting her own words. "Let me guess what you've been doing today. By all that dirt, I'd say digging a hole. With your bare hands, or did they let you use a spoon? When they decide it's finished, they will just make you fill it again, you know. Now let me see. Every part I can see of you is grubby, but that robe is clean, so I expect they had you digging in your skin. Are you sure you don't want healing? Sunburn can be painful." She filled another cup with water and wafted it across the tent on a flow of air to hover in front of Beldine. "Your throat must be parched." The young green stared unsteadily at the cup for a moment, then suddenly her legs gave way and she collapsed onto a cushion with a bitter laugh. "They water me frequently." She laughed again, though Verin could not see the joke. "As much as I want, so long as I swallow it all." Studying Verin angrily, she paused, then went on in a tight voice, "That dress looks very nice on you. They burned mine. I saw them. They stole everything except this." She touched the golden great serpent around her left forefinger, a bright golden gleam among the dirt. "I suppose they couldn't find quite enough nerve for that. I know what they're trying to do, Verin, and it won't work. Not with me. Not with any of us." She was still on her guard. Varen set the cup down on the flowered carpet beside Beldine, then took up her own and sipped before speaking.
Oh? What are they trying to do?
This time the other woman's laugh was brittle as well as harsh. Break us, and you know it. Make us swear oaths to Althor the way you did. Oh, Varen, how could you? Swearing fealty, and worse, to a man, to him. Even if you could bring yourself to rebel against the Ammerlin seat, against the White Tower. She made the two sound much the same. How could you do that? For a moment, Varen wondered whether things would be better if the women now held in the Aiel camp had been caught up as she had been, a wood chip in the mill race of Randall Thor's Taviran swirl, words pouring from her mouth before they had time to form in her brain. Not words she could never have said on her own. That was not how Taviran affected you. But words she might possibly have said one time in 1,000 under those circumstances. One time in 10,000. No, the arguments had been long and hot over whether oaths given in that way had to be kept, and the arguments over how to keep them still continued, much better as it was. Absently she fingered a hard shape inside her belt pouch, a small brooch, a translucent stone, carved into what appeared to be a lily with too many petals. She never wore it, but it had not been out of her reach in nearly 50 years.
You are Datsang, Beldine. You must have heard that.
She did not need Beldine's curt nod. Telling the despised one was part of Aiel law, like pronouncing sentence. That much she knew, if very little more. Your clothes and anything else that would burn were put to the fire because no Aiel would own anything that once belonged to a Datsang. The rest was hacked to pieces or hammered into scrap, even the jewelry you had with you, and buried under a pit, dug for a jakes.
My horse?
Beldine asked anxiously. They didn't kill the horses, but I don't know where yours is. Being ridden by someone in the city, probably, or perhaps given to an Ashaman. Telling her that might do more harm than good. Varen seemed to recall that Beldine was one of those young women who had very deep feelings for horses. They let you keep the ring to remind you of who you were and increase your shame. I don't know whether they would let you swear to Master Althor if you begged. It would take something incredible on your part, I think.
I won't. Never.
The words rang hollow, though, and Beldine's shoulders slumped. She was shaken, but not sufficiently. Varen put on a warm smile. A fellow had once told her that her smile made him think of his dear mother. She hoped he had not been lying about that, at least. He had tried to slide a dagger between her ribs a little later, and her smile had been the last thing he ever saw. I can't think of the reason you would. No, I fear what you have to look forward to is useless labor. That's shaming to them, bone shaming. Of course, if they realize you don't see it that way... Oh, my. I'll wager you didn't like digging without any clothes on, even with maidens for guards, but think of, say, standing in a tent full of men that way? Beldine flinched. Varen prattled on. She had developed prattling to something of a talent. They'd only make you stand there, of course. Datsang aren't allowed to do anything useful unless there's great need, and an Aiel man would as soon put his arm around a rotting carcass as... Well, that's not a pleasant thought, is it? In any case, that's what you have to look forward to. I know you'll resist as long as you can, though I'm not sure what there is to resist. They won't try to get information out of you, or anything that people usually do with prisoners. But they won't let you go, not ever, until they're sure the shame is so deep in you there's nothing else left. Not if it takes the rest of your life. Beldine's lips moved soundlessly, but she might as well have spoken the words, "The rest of my life." Shifting uncomfortably on her cushion, she grimaced. Sunburn or welts or simply the ache of unaccustomed work.
"We will be rescued," she said finally.
"The Ammerlin won't leave us. We'll be rescued or we'll... We will be rescued!" Snatching up the silver cup from beside her, she tilted her head back to gulp until it was empty, then thrust it out for more. Varen floated the pewter pitcher over and set it down so the young woman could pour for herself.
"Or you'll escape?"
Varen said, and Beldine's dirty hands jerked, splashing water down the sides of the cup.
Really, now, you have as much chance of that as you do of rescue. You're surrounded by an army of Aiel. And apparently Al-Thor can call up a few hundred of those Ashaman whenever he wants, to hunt you down.
The other woman shivered at that, and Varen nearly did. That little mess should have been stopped as soon as it started.
No, I fear you must make your own way somehow. Deal with things as they are. You are quite alone in this. I know they don't let you speak to the others.
Quite alone, she sighed. Wide eyes stared at her as they might have at a red adder.
There's no need to make it worse than it must be. Let me heal you.
She barely waited for the other woman's pitiful nod before moving to kneel beside her and place hands on Beldine's head. The young woman was almost as ready as she could be. Opening herself to more of Saidar, Varen wove the flows of healing, and the green gasped and quivered. The half-filled cup dropped from her hands, and a flailing arm knocked the pitcher onto its side. Now she was as ready as she could be. In the moments of confusion that gripped anyone after being healed, while Beldine still blinked and tried to come back to herself, Varen opened herself further, opened herself through the carved flower Ungreal in her pouch. Not a very powerful Ungreal, but enough, and she needed every bit of the extra power it gave her for this. The flows she began weaving bore no resemblance to healing. Spirit predominated by far, but there was wind and water, fire and earth, the last of some difficulty for her, and even the skeins of spirit had to be divided again and again, placed with an intricacy to boggle a weaver of fine carpets. Even if a wise one poked her head into the tent, with the smallest of luck she would not possess the rare talent needed to realize what Varen was doing. There would still be difficulties, perhaps painful difficulties one way and another, but she could live with anything short of true discovery.
What?
Beldine said drowsily. Her head would have lolled except for Varen's grip, and her eyelids were half closed.
What are you... What is happening?
Nothing that will harm you, Varen told her reassuringly. The woman might die inside the year, or in 10, as a result of this, but the weave itself would not harm her. I promise you, this is safe enough to use on an infant. Of course, that depended on what you did with it. She needed to lay the flows in place thread by thread, but talking seemed to help rather than hinder, and too long a silence might rouse suspicion if her twin guardians were listening. Her eyes darted frequently to the dangling door flaps. She wanted some answers she had no intention of sharing, answers none of the women she questioned were likely to give freely even if they knew them. One of the smaller effects of this weave was to loosen the tongue and open the mind as well as any herb ever could, an effect that came on quickly. Dropping her voice almost to a whisper, she continued,
"The Al-Thor boy seems to think he has supporters of some kind inside the White Tower, Beldine. In secret, of course. They must be."
Even a man with his ear pressed to the fabric of the tent should be able to hear only that they were talking. "Tell me anything you know about them."
"Supporters?"
Beldine murmured, attempting a frown that seemed beyond her ability. She stirred, though it hardly deserved the word agitation, feeble and uncoordinated.
"For him? Among the sisters? It can't be. Except for those of you who..." "How could you, Varen? Why didn't you fight it?"
Varen tisked vexedly. Not for the foolish suggestion that she should have fought a Taviren. The boy seemed so certain.
"Why?"
She kept her voice low. "Do you have no suspicions, Beldine? Did you hear no rumors before you left Tarvalon? No whispers? No one who hinted at approaching him differently? Tell me."
"No one. Who could? No one would. I admired Kiruna so."
There was a hint of loss in Beldine's sleepy voice, and tears leaking from her eyes made tracks through the dirt. Only Varen's hands kept her sitting upright. Varen continued to lay down the threads of her weaving, eyes flashing from her work to the door flaps and back. She felt a little like sweating herself. Sorelia might decide she needed help with the questioning. She might bring out one of the sisters from the Sun Palace. Should any sister learn of this, stilling was a very real possibility.
"So you were going to deliver him to Elida, neatly washed and well-behaved," she said in a slightly louder tone. The quiet had gone on too long. She did not want that pair outside reporting that she was whispering with the prisoners.
"I couldn't speak out against Galena's decision. She led by the Ammerlin's command."
Beldine shifted again, weakly. Her voice was still dreamy, but it picked up an agitated edge. Her eyelids fluttered.
"He had to be made to obey. He had to be. Shouldn't have been treated so harshly, like putting him to question. Wrong."
Varen snorted. "Wrong? Disastrous was more like it. A disaster from the first. Now the man looked at any Aes Sedai almost the way Aeron did. And if they had succeeded in carrying him to Tar Valon? A Ta'veren like Randall Thor actually inside the White Tower? A thought to make a stone tremble. However it had turned out, disaster would surely have been too mild a word. The price paid at Dumai's Wells was small enough for avoiding that." She went on asking questions in a tone that could be heard clearly by anyone listening outside, asking questions she already had answers for, and avoiding those too dangerous to be answered. She paid little heed to the words coming out of her mouth, or to Beldine's replies. Mainly she concentrated on her weaving. A great many things had captured her interest over the years, not all strictly approved of by the Tower. Almost every Wilder who came to the White Tower for training, both true Wilders who really had begun teaching themselves, and girls who merely had started touching the source because the spark born in them had quickened on its own. For some sisters there was no real difference. Nearly every one of those Wilders had created at least one trick for herself, and those tricks almost invariably fell under one of two headings. A way to listen in on other people's conversations, or a way of making people do as they wanted. The first, the Tower did not care much about. Even a Wilder who had gained considerable control on her own quickly learned that as long as she wore novice white, she was not to so much as touch Sidar without a sister or one of the accepted standing over her, which did tend to limit eavesdropping rather sharply. The other trick, however, smelled too akin to forbidden compulsion. Oh, it was just a way to make father give her dresses or trinkets he did not want to buy, or make mother approve of young men she ordinarily ran off, things of that nature. But the Tower rooted the trick out most effectively. Many of the girls and women Varen had spoken to over the years could not make themselves form the weaves, much less use them, and a fair number could not even make themselves remember how. From bits and pieces and scraps of half-remembered weaves carried by untrained girls for very limited purposes, Varen had reconstructed a thing forbidden by the Tower since its founding. In the beginning it had been simple curiosity on her part. Curiosity, she thought wryly, working at the weave on Beldine, has made me climb into more than one pickling kettle. Usefulness came later. "I suppose Elida meant to keep him down in the open cells," she said conversationally. The grill-walled cells were intended for men who could channel, as well as initiates of the Tower under close arrest, Wilders who had claimed to be Aes Sedai, and anyone else who must be both confined and blocked off from the source. "Not a comfortable place for the Dragon Reborn. No privacy." "Do you believe he is the Dragon Reborn, Beldine?" This time she paused to listen.
"Yes."
The word was a long hiss, and Beldine rolled frightened eyes toward Varen's face.
"Yes, but he must be kept safe. The world must be safe from him."
Interesting. They had all said the world had to be kept safe from him. What was interesting was those who thought he needed protection, too. Some who had said that surprised her. To Varen's eyes, the weave she had made resembled nothing so much as a haphazard tangle of faintly glowing transparent threads, all bundled around Beldine's head, with four threads of spirit trailing out of the mess. Two of those, opposite one another, she pulled, and the tangle collapsed slightly, falling inward into something on the edge of order. Beldine's eyes shot wide open,
staring into the far distance. In a firm, low voice, Varen gave her instructions. More like suggestions, though she phrased them as commands. Beldine would have to find reasons within herself to obey. If she did not, then all this had been so much wasted effort. With the final words, Varen pulled the other two threads of spirit, and the tangle collapsed further. This time, though, it fell into what seemed perfect order, a pattern more precise, more complicated than the most intricate lace, and complete, tied off by the same action that began its shrinking. This time it continued to fall inward on itself, inward around Beldine's head. Those faintly glowing threads sank into her, vanished. Her eyes rolled back in her head, and she began to thrash, limbs quivering. Varen held her as gently as she could, but Beldine's head still whipped from side to side, and her bare heels drummed on the carpets. Soon only the most careful delving would tell that anything had been done, and not even that would identify the weave. Varen had tested that carefully, and if she did say so herself, none surpassed her at delving. Of course the thing was not truly compulsion as ancient texts described it. The weaving went with painful slowness, cobbled together as it was, and there was that need for a reason. It helped a great deal if the object of the weave was emotionally vulnerable, but trust was absolutely essential. Even catching someone by surprise did no good if they were suspicious. That fact cut down its usefulness with men considerably. Very few men lacked suspicion around Aes Sedai. Distrust aside, men were very bad subjects, unfortunately. She could not understand why. Most of those girls' weaves had been intended for their fathers or other men. Any strong personality might begin to question his own actions, or even forget doing them, which led to another set of problems. But all things being equal, men were much more likely to. Much more likely. Perhaps it was the suspicion again. Why, once a man had even remembered the weaves being woven on him, if not the instructions she had given him. Such a lot of bother that caused. Not something she would risk again. At last, Beldine's convulsions lessened, stopped. She raised a filthy hand to her head.
What happened? She said, almost inaudibly. Did I faint?
Forgetfulness was another good point about the weave. Not unexpectedly. After all, father must not remember that you somehow made him buy that expensive dress. The heat is very bad, Varen said, helping her to sit up again. I have felt light-headed myself once or twice today. From weariness, not heat. Handling that much of Sidar took it out of you, especially when you had already done it 4 times today. The Ungrial did nothing to buffer the effects once you stopped using it. She could have used a steadying hand herself. I think that's about enough. If you're fainting, perhaps they'll find something for you to do out of the sun. The prospect did not seem to cheer Beldine at all. Rubbing the small of her back, Varen stuck her head out of the tent. Koram and Mendan stopped their game of cat's cradle once more. There was no sign that either had listened, but she would not wager her life on it. She told them that she was finished with Beldine, and after a moment's thought added that she needed another pitcher of water, since Beldine had overturned hers. Both men's faces darkened beneath their tans. That would be passed along to the wise one who came for Beldine. It would serve as something more to help her reach her decision. The sun still had a long way to fall to the horizon, but the ache in her back told her it was time to stop for the day. She could still do one more sister, but if she did, by morning she would feel it in every muscle. Her eyes fell on Ergine, now with the women carrying baskets to the handmills. How would her life have gone if she had not been so curious, Varen wondered. For one thing, she would have married Edwin, and remained in Farmadding instead of going to the White Tower. She would be long dead for another, and the children she had never had, and her grandchildren, too. With a sigh, she turned back to Koram. When Mendan returns, would you go tell Kulinda that I would like to see Ergine Fatamed? The pain in her muscles tomorrow would be a small penance for Beldine's suffering over that spilled water, But that was not why she did it, or even her curiosity, really. She still had a task. Somehow she had to keep young Rand alive until it was time for him to die.
The room might have been in a grand palace, except that it had neither windows nor doors. The fire on a golden marble hearth gave no heat, and the flames did not consume the logs. The man seated at a table with gilded legs, centered on a silk carpet, woven with glittering threads of gold and silver, cared little for the trappings of this age. They were necessary to impress, no more. Not that he really needed more than himself to overawe the stiffest pride. He called himself Moradin, and surely no one had ever had more right to name himself Death. From time to time he idly stroked one of the two mind traps that hung on plain silken cords around his neck. At his touch, the blood-red crystal of the Coursouvre pulsed, swirls moving in endless depths like the beating of a heart. His real attention was on the game laid out before him on the table. 33 red pieces and 33 green, arrayed across a playing surface of 13 squares by 13. A recreation of the early stages of a famous game. The most important piece, the fisher, black and white like the playing surface, still waited in its starting place on the central square. A complex game, Shara, ancient long before the War of Power. Shara, Charon, and Nori, the game now called simply Stones, each had adherents who claimed it encompassed all the subtleties of life. But Moradin had always favored Shara. Only 9 people living even remembered the game. He had been a master of it. Much more complex than Charon or Nori. The first object was capture of the fisher. Only then did the game truly begin. A servant approached, a slim, graceful young man clad all in white, impossibly handsome, bowing as he presented a crystal goblet on a silver tray. He smiled, but it did not touch his black eyes, eyes more lifeless than simply dead. Most men would have felt uncomfortable having that gaze on them. Moradin merely took the goblet and motioned the servant away. The vintners of this time produced some excellent wines. He did not drink, though. The fisher had his attention, baiting him. Several pieces had varying moves, but only the fisher's attributes altered according to where it stood. On a white square, weak in attack, yet agile and far-ranging in escape. On black, strong in attack, but slow and vulnerable. When masters played, the fisher changed sides many times before the end. The green and red goal row that surrounded the playing surface could be threatened by any piece, but only the fisher could move on to it. Not that he was safe even there. The fisher was never safe. When the fisher was yours, you tried to move him to a square of your color behind your opponent's end of the board. That was victory, the easiest way, but not the only one. When your opponent held the fisher, you attempted to leave him no choice for the fisher but to move on to your color. Anywhere at all along the goal roll would do. Holding the fisher could be more dangerous than not. Of course, there was a third path to victory in Shara, if you took it before letting yourself be trapped. The game always degenerated into a bloody melee. Then, victory coming only with complete annihilation of your enemy. He had tried that once, in desperation. But the attempt had failed. Painfully. Fury boiled suddenly in Moradin's head, and black flecks swam across his eyes as he seized the true power. Ecstasy that amounted to pain thundered through him. His hand closed around the two mind traps, and the true power closed around the fissure, snatching it into the air, a hair from crushing it to powder, crushing the powder out of existence. The goblet shattered in his hand. His grip bordered on crushing the Coursouvre. The Sa were a blizzard of black, but they did not hinder his sight. The fisher was always worked as a man, a bandage blinding his eyes and one hand pressed to his side, a few drops of blood dripping through his fingers. The reasons, like the source of the name, were lost in the mist of time. That troubled him sometimes, enraged him, what knowledge might be lost in the turnings of the wheel. Knowledge he needed, knowledge he had a right to. A right! Slowly he set the fisher back on the board. Slowly his fingers uncurled from around the Coursouvre. There was no need for destruction. Yet. Icy calm replaced rage in the blink of an eye. Blood and wine dripped from his gashed hand, unnoticed. Perhaps the fissure did come from some dim remnant of a memory of Randall Thor. The shadow of a shadow. It did not matter. He realized he was laughing, and made no effort to stop. On the board, the fissure stood waiting, but in the greater game, Althor moved already to his wishes. And soon now? It was very hard to lose a game when you played both sides of the board. Moradin laughed so hard that tears rolled down his face, but he was not aware of them.
Chapter 1. To Keep the Bargain. The wheel of time turns, and ages come and pass, leaving memories that become legend. Legend fades to myth, and even myth is long forgotten when the age that gave it birth comes again. In one age, called the Third Age by some, an age yet to come, an age long past, a wind rose above the great mountainous island of Trimalking. The wind was not the beginning. There are neither beginnings nor endings to the turning of the wheel of time, but it was a beginning. East the wind blew across Trimalking, where the fair-skinned Amayar farmed their fields, and made fine glass and porcelain, and followed the peace of the waterway. The Amayar ignored the world beyond their scattered islands, for the waterway taught that this world was only illusion, a mirrored reflection of belief. Yet some watched the wind carry dust and deep summer heat where cold winter rains should be falling, and they remembered tales heard from the Atha'an Mi'er. Tales of the world beyond, and what prophecy said was to come. Some looked to a hill, where a massive stone hand rose from the earth, holding a clear crystal sphere larger than many houses. The Amayar had their own prophecies, and some of those spoke of the hand and the sphere, and the end of illusions. Onward the wind blew into the sea of storms, eastward beneath the searing sun, in a sky abandoned by clouds, whipping the tops of green sea-swells, battling winds from the south and westward winds, shearing and swirling as the waters below heaved. Not yet the storms of winter's heart, though winter should have been half gone, much less the greater storms of a dying summer, but winds and currents that could be used by ocean-faring folk to coast around the continent from World's End to Mei Yen and beyond, then back again. Eastward the wind howled, over rolling ocean where the great whales rose and sounded, and flying fish soared on outstretched fins 2 paces and more across. Eastward, now whirling north, east and north, over small fleets of fishing ships dragging their nets in the shallower seas. Some of those fishermen stood gaping, hands idle on the lines, staring at a huge array of tall vessels and smaller that purposefully rode the wind's hard breath, shattering swells with bluff bows, slicing swells with narrow, their banner a golden hawk with talons clutching lightning, a multitude of streaming banners like portents of storm. East and north and on, and the wind reached the broad, ship-filled harbor of Ebu Dar, where hundreds of sea-folk vessels rode as they did in many ports, awaiting word of the Koramor, the Chosen One. Across the harbor the wind roared, tossing small ships and large, across the city itself, gleaming white beneath the unfettered sun, spires and walls and color-ringed domes, streets and canals bustling with the storied southern industry. Around the shining domes and slender towers of the Tarasin Palace the wind swirled, carrying the tang of salt, lifting the flag of Altara, 2 golden leopards on a field of red and blue, and the banners of ruling House Mitzabar, the sword and anchor, green on white. Not yet the storm, but a harbinger of storms. Skin prickled between Avienda's shoulder blades as she strode ahead of her companions through palace hallways tiled in dozens of pleasing bright hues. A sense of being watched that she had last felt while still wed to the spear. Imagination, she told herself. Imagination and knowing there are enemies about I cannot face. Not so long ago that crawling sensation had meant someone might be intending to kill her. Death was nothing to fear. Everyone died, today or on another.
but she did not want to die like a rabbit kicking in a snare. She had Toe to meet. Servants scurried by close along the walls, bobbing bows and curtsies, dropping their eyes almost as if they understood the shame of the lives they lived, yet surely it could not be them that made her want to twist her shoulders. She had tried schooling herself to see servants, but even now, with the skin creeping on her back, her gaze slid around them. It had to be imagination and nerves. This was a day for imagination and nerves. Unlike the servants, rich silk tapestries snagged at her eye, and the gilded stand lamps and ceiling lamps lining the corridors. Paper-thin porcelain in reds and yellows and greens and blues stood in wall niches and tall openwork cabinets, alongside ornaments of gold and silver, ivory and crystal, scores upon scores of bowls and vases and caskets and statuettes. Only the most beautiful truly caught her gaze. Whatever Wetlanders thought, beauty held more worth than gold. There was much beauty here. She would not have minded taking her share of the fifth from this place. Vexed with herself, she frowned. That was not an honorable thought beneath a roof that had offered her shade and water freely. Without ceremony, true, but also without debt or blood, steel or need. Yet better that than thinking about a small boy alone somewhere out in this corrupt city. Any city was corrupt. Of that much she was certain now, having seen some part of four. But Ebu Dar was the last where she would have let a child run loose. What she could not understand was why thoughts of Alver came unless she worked hard to avoid them. He was no part of the Toe she had to Elaine and to Randall Thor. A Shido spear had taken his father, starvation and hardship his mother. Yet had it been her own spear that took both, the boy was still a tree-killer, Kyrienin. Why should she fret over a child from that blood? Why? She attempted to concentrate on the weave she was to make, but although she had practiced it under Elaine's eye until she could have formed it sleeping, Alver's wide-mouthed face intruded. Birgitta worried about him even more than she, but Birgitta's breast held a strangely soft heart for small boys, especially ugly ones.